From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Midnight Madness has passed, and the he's and she's of the collegiate hardwood are picking and rolling on the road to the madness of March. Ahead on Only a Game, men's and women's season previews. Also, North Carolina keeps its soccer pitches green during the Southeast's record drought, and we open the Only a Game mailbag. Also ahead, University of Pennsylvania football fans toast their team with toast.
They won't let you in with bagels, and I understand that. It's bagels are dangerous.
But they fly better.
Wendy.
What? But they do fly better.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Kentucky started out as number 20 in the polls, then learned against the Gardner-Webbs the ball it sometimes rolls in ways that lead to upsets, turns the urchin to a deb. And by the way, can someone tell me, what's a Gardner-Webb? Here to help me answer that question, as well as understand the 07-08 edition of the men's college basketball season, is ESPN's Pat Forty. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here. I don't know what a Gardner-Webb is, but it's better than Kentucky. I know that much.
They demonstrated that. Grayson Flitner, who sounds about as much like a law firm as Gardner-Webb does, may not sound like a person with the ability to crush an entire state, but that is exactly what Mr. Flitner and the Gardner-Webb basketball team did this week. The Running Bulldogs went to the University of Kentucky, routed the Wildcats 84-68. Is this an upset worthy of the title biggest ever?
It's certainly the biggest in Kentucky history, which puts it on a very short list. This is a team that lost 21 games last year, and you come in and ride a former walk-on from a town of 600 in Indiana, Mr. Flitner, and you route Kentucky, the winningest program in history, in front of 24,000 disbelieving fans, never trail in the game. It's pretty remarkable. We haven't seen one like this maybe since Chaminade beat Ralph Sampson in Virginia.
Tubby Smith left Kentucky for the University of Minnesota amid much jeering. If you listened closely enough, could you hear his hysterical laughter all the way from the Twin Cities?
I believe so, yes. Now, Tubby is so guarded that he would never, ever, ever let that on in public, but I would be shocked if he didn't, you know, light up a quality cigar and have a big puff and a big laugh at Kentucky's expense.
Pat, last year there were eight teams that were clearly better than the rest of the teams in Division One, and sure enough, four of those teams met in the Final Four, with Florida emerging as a repeat champion. Maybe the teams will be different this year, but is the pattern the same?
I don't think so. I think the talent level at the top is a little more broadly spread. I think there's probably seven teams that everybody has been kind of putting in one big pot, but I think there's plenty of room for other ones to get up there. As we've already seen, there's been two Division II teams win exhibition games against the top 10 Michigan State team, against Ohio State. There's been Gardner-Webb win. Morgan State nearly beat Connecticut. I think we're in for one of those years where the upset is going to be a very prevalent theme.
Well, we should get, since you mentioned top seven or so in the same pot, give me your sense of who those top seven are likely to be.
For me, it starts with Memphis. Probably by far the most talent that John Calipari has had on the roster. They've had some significant pratfalls the last two regional finals, but I think they're ready to take that next step. They have a virtuoso freshman point guard in Derrick Rose, who I think really kind of gives them the missing element that they didn't quite have before. And then after that, I think there's a bunch of other teams right there. North Carolina, obviously, with a lot of talent. Roy Williams got a couple of guys to not go pro, which is a big part of being good from year to year these days.
Mm-hmm.
UCLA, maybe they're the Atlanta Braves or something, where they are an excellent year in and year out, and I think they're going to be under Ben Howland. The question is, how many times can they close the deal? They've been punked twice by Florida in the Final Four. Maybe this is the year they get over the top. I think Georgetown and Louisville, both from the Big East, should have excellent seasons. Kansas from the Big 12, and Tennessee probably from the SEC. I think those teams have kind of got a little bit of an edge on everybody else.
It seemed as if last year every story in college basketball was about either Kevin Durant or Greg Oden, except for the ones that were about Greg Oden or Kevin Durant, and that left only the ones about Kevin Durant or Greg Oden. Anyway, those two are now collecting NBA paychecks. Which players will we be entirely sick of hearing about by next March?
Probably Tyler Hansbrough with North Carolina. It is different. It's interesting that there's not a face of this season yet. Now, there may not be an Oden or Durant where a guy that's just absolutely dominant right away, but I think there are more good freshmen in this class than any I've ever seen. There's at least 12, maybe 15 guys that will be, among the very best players on their team. Some of them will be the stars and the leading scorers for their teams. And on good teams, we're talking about Memphis and UCLA and USC and on down the line. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of faces for 1 year, just like we saw Oden and Durant for 1 year.
Well, of those 12 to 15 magnificent freshmen, it's a good bet that 12 to 15 of them will come out after 1 year. The NBA minimum age of 19 has been in place now for 1 year. Can you tell if forcing players who are really ready to play in the NBA to go to college for 1 year instead is a good thing?
I think it probably makes a bit of a mockery of the higher education system in terms of what you're basically doing is shanghaiing these guys for 1 year to do something they have no interest in doing. It's true that, there's probably other guys that are there that don't have much interest in it either, the guys that are playing 2 and 3 and 4 years.
I was going to say, some of them don't even play basketball.
Well, that's true, too. I think I had a couple roommates like that. At least before they had the option of skipping the whole charade and going to the NBA, and now they don't have that. And so, you're putting the backpack on their back and the textbooks in their hands, but do they really want them and do they really care? I doubt it.
Finally, Pat, the NCAA has found a way to clean up the game, at least on the sideline. Coaches who swear during games will be charged with a technical foul and they'll be ejected after a second violation. Will this lead to a kinder, gentler Bob Knight and Mike Krzyzewski?
Oh, I can't wait to see whether this will be reinforced, Bill, because this rule has always existed. They just never paid any attention to it. And now that the horse has been out of the barn and galloping around on the field for 20 years, we're going to try to put the horse back in. I'm not sure the horse is going to be real happy about that. So I can't wait to see, how long it takes for technicals to be assessed, if they give them a warning or if they just bang them right away, and then what the response is. I think it's definitely needed. I think it's a welcome tightening of that rule if they enforce it, and I hope that the coaches can abide by it without too much kicking and screaming and ejecting.
Well, I have to congratulate you, Pat. That may be the most tortured metaphor we've ever had on Only a Game.
That horse is doing some work out there.
He's going to be in my head throughout the entire basketball season.
Every time a coach is out of the coaching box, you can think of that thoroughbred galloping across the field.
Pat Forte is a national columnist who covers college basketball for ESPN. Pat, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill. Enjoy the season.
College football is full of eccentric traditions. At Notre Dame, the helmets get a fresh coat of gold spray paint before every game. The players at Clemson touch Howard's Rock for good luck before every home game, but few traditions are as downright weird as the one practiced at the University of Pennsylvania. At the end of the third quarter, fans bombard the field with toast. Reporter Joel Rose of WHYY in Philadelphia attended a game earlier this season to figure out why.
The Quakers play their home games at Franklin Field. At first glance, it looks like your typical college football game. You've got your fans, your mascots, your cheerleaders. But look a little closer, and you'll see that most of the Penn fans have brought toast to their seats. Sarah Fleischer is a junior from Westchester, New York.
You've got a lot of toast there.
Yeah, I prepared. We all have stacks of it ready, so I do it every game.
At the correct moment, the end of the third quarter, Fleischer and everyone else in the stadium will hurl their toast at the field. The university doesn't exactly discourage this behavior. On the contrary, Penn conveniently provides dozens of loaves of white bread and an industrial-sized toaster near the main entrance to the stadium. That's where I found Matt Harrison, a freshman from Atlanta, feeding bread into the toaster.
There's a song, and it's, drink a highball at nightfall, and we'll toast a dear old Penn.
It used to be a tradition where everyone would bring actual alcohol to the game and have a toast to dear old Penn while they sang the song.
And after sort of that was no longer acceptable, alcohol at these football games,
It was replaced with an actual piece of toast.
Senior Cynthia Wright and recent graduate Alexis Ruby Howe are sitting in the front row, toast at the ready. Ruby Howe works in the alumni relations office at Penn. She says the toast-throwing tradition started 30 years ago, about the same time the Rocky Horror Picture Show was a nationwide fad. What started out as a joke is now a ritual that stood the test of time and inclement weather, says Cynthia Wright.
They still throw it when it rains. It's just harder for people to clean up. It's pretty disgusting. And a lot of times the cheerleaders get hit, so it's become kind of a safety issue. And the men usually stand in front of the girls like when they're throwing because people target them.
What does it say about Penn that this joke about toast has, you know, really survived down through the years? What does it say about that?
Well, it lets you know that Penn's kind of a laid-back place that they'll let you throw toast in the middle of a football game.
David Lynn graduated from Penn's Wharton School in 1989. Today he's introducing his stepdaughter, Wendy Bauer, to the tradition. No matter how laid-back the school appears, though, Lynn says there are some rules.
They won't let you in with bagels, and I understand that. It's bagels are dangerous.
But they fly better.
Wendy?
What? But they do fly better.
Hold the toast.
That completes the third quarter of play with a score of 10-35. First down.
Clearly, this is the moment everyone has been waiting for. That's the cue. Instantly, 1,000 pieces of toast are flying in the general direction of the cheerleaders and the football field beyond. They're mostly slices of white bread, though sure enough, some of the undergrads have wadded the stuff into bread balls that can fly surprisingly far. Not much of the toast actually makes it all the way to the AstroTurf, but the track is a mess.
Here we go, toast man, here we go!
And then it appears, the toast Zamboni. You know the vehicle that polishes the ice between periods in a hockey game? It looks like that, except it's been adapted to suck toast off the track. The students seem to welcome its arrival, if only because it gives them something new to aim at.
They throw toast at you while you're out there?
Yeah. Bagels, toast, pizza, everything. Yeah. I got hit by it a couple times.
This is Juan Torres, a.k.a. Toast Man. He's been driving the toast Zamboni for 11 years.
Does it seem kind of mean that they're throwing toast at you? You don't take it personally, I guess.
No, I don't take it personally. I can't take it personally. It just keeps, you know, have fun.
To be honest, by Penn standards, today's pile of toast isn't that impressive. Tony Overend has been the facilities manager at Franklin Field for 17 years.
It's kind of small, but in the past you've had 20 to 30,000. You're talking maybe 8 to 15,000 today.
That's 8 to 15,000 pieces of toast. Most of the time, Overend considers the tradition to be harmless, even fun, but he concedes it can be a real pain when it's raining.
What happens is the toast disintegrates, and generally we wait till the next day. We pick up all, as much as we can with the guys of the rigs. Rainy, wet days, a long day.
But today isn't a rainy day. It takes the grounds crew only a few minutes to rake up what the Zamboni left behind, and Franklin Field once again resembles a normal college football stadium. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Evidence of enthusiasm for the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, where the games will be held, is apparent in China's most recent identity card database. Nearly 3,500 Chinese children, most of them living outside Beijing, have been named Aiyun, which means Olympics. Somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 Chinese youngsters have been saddled with the names of the mascots for the 08 Games, meaning that these kids will answer to Bei Bei, Jing Jing, Wan Wan, Ying Ying, or Ni Ni. When those names are strung together, they form a phrase that translates as Beijing welcomes you. But these children will not be forced to travel everywhere as a unit. Unless they are. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the green grass at the home of the UNC women's soccer team and why some people don't like it. But first, for a women's college basketball preview, I'm joined by Michelle Smith, who writes about women's hoops for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
a new season. Great to be back.
Conversations of this sort often start with a mention of the defending champion. What are the reasons other than superstar Candace Parker and legendary coach Pat Summitt to think Tennessee might be pretty good again?
They are very good. I mean, they have a lot of kids back. They've got, you know, they've got Alexis Hornbuckle and Nikki Anasicki, and this is a very talented team above and beyond the fact that they have the best player in the country in Candace Parker. And then they have a very good freshman in Angie Bjorklund, who was one of the top recruits in the country last year, I think number two or three behind a couple of the kids that ended up at UConn. So they are in a very good position to defend a title that took them, what was it, 7 or 8 years to win again?
Yeah. No coach has won more women's championships than Pat Summitt. However, Van Chancellor, the 64-year-old new coach at LSU, has led teams to an Olympic gold medal and to the WNBA championship. Can he achieve the triple with Louisiana State?
Possibly. He has one outstanding player in his center, Sylvia Fowles. I don't know if it's LSU's time. They've been to the Final Four quite a few times and haven't gotten over that hump. I'm not sure they're quite the caliber of Tennessee and maybe Connecticut now that Geno has reloaded. And Maryland is, I think, certainly poised to do better than they did last year. Rutgers is very good. I mean, there are some elite teams, and I'm not sure. I think that LSU is maybe in that second tier.
You mentioned Connecticut, which most people have picked second behind Tennessee this time around. Connecticut has one big advantage over previous UConn aggregations. They don't have to play Tennessee. Pat Summitt no longer wants her team associating with Geno or Emmasquad.
To women's basketball fans everywhere, yes. I mean, that game isn't going to happen, and that is hugely disappointing, and it's Pat's decision. And Geno has made some noise about it because I think clearly he would like that for his program. It's always a national TV game. It's always probably the highest profile game of the year that's not the tournament. And, you know, it is disappointing. Pat has her reasons for doing it, and she doesn't want to say what they are, which clearly to me seems to indicate that they're personal. But, you know, it is. It's going to be a gigantic hole, I think, in the season.
Well, a hole in the season, but now how big a deal does it become if UConn plays Tennessee in the tournament, even if it's not the finals?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, those brackets are going to have those two. I can't imagine a bracket that doesn't have UConn and Tennessee meeting before at least the, you know, national semifinal. I can see these two teams in the final. I think a lot of people can. And, you know, then it just becomes, well, a circus. Because then it's Geno versus Pat. It's Geno calling Pat out about why she called off the game. It's Pat maybe at that point, you know, illuminating a bit on her decision. I don't know, but it would be a very interesting couple of days.
Rutgers, runner-up to Tennessee last spring, is also among the highly regarded teams this season. Coach C. Vivian Stringer gets all five starters back, which never hurts. Will the experience make them one critical game better than they were last year?
But they need to be better offensively. Rutgers has been that defensive team, that team that's not like any team you face all year because they pressure you so intensely and, you know, that very good team. And I think, though, when you get to the end of the tournament and you've played six really, you know, hard-fought games, that you need more than that, and they need to be a better, more productive offensive team. And I think that would be enough maybe to get them back to the title game.
Can you give us a long shot for this season?
Well, you know, long shots in women's basketball are teams that are maybe ranked 7 and 8 instead of 1, 2, or 3. I think Texas is an interesting team with Gail Gestenkor's move from Duke. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how quickly she'll be able to turn it. I think they're a dangerous team. Another west of the Mississippi team that I think is going to have an interesting year would be California. All the starters back. They have Devin A. Hampton was the Pac-10 Player of the Year. Ashley Walker, they are a fantastic post tandem. And they're juniors now. And I think that that team will make a little noise. If you're talking about long shots for the title, then, you know, I think you're talking maybe about teams like Duke with Joanne P. McCallie. You might be talking about Stanford with Candace Wiggins, who is, you know, one of probably the three best players in the country. It's, you know, long shots for women's basketball are hard to call because they don't often come in.
No, it's interesting that when we're having this discussion, the phrase, they're getting everybody back, comes up. This, of course, never comes up in this discussion of elite men's basketball teams, because after 1 year, two at most, the very best players turn pro and go to the NBA. How is it that that doesn't happen with the WNBA?
Well, the WNBA has a rule in place that a player cannot join the league unless she has completed. It's not 4 years of eligibility, but I think it's there's a graduation requirement to it somehow. What's going to be interesting this year is that Candace Parker redshirted her freshman year. This will be her third year of eligibility. She is an athletic junior. She graduates from Tennessee in December, and while she has said publicly that she will come back for another year, in the hypothetical, if they were to win another title, she wins two titles in a row, the number one pick in the WNBA draft is going to the Los Angeles Sparks,
mm-hmm.
where someone will be the heir apparent to Lisa Leslie. Will it be Candace Parker after 3 years of college? A lot of people think it will.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball teams for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she joins me to talk about same on Only a Game from time to time. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
For the past 14 holiday seasons, Only a Game has assisted frantic shoppers in their quest to find the perfect sports-related gifts for friends and loved ones. Who can forget the hockey rosary, the baseball mitt chair, soccer Jesus, or the Red Sox-Yankees chess set? Or how about my conversation last year with Brooks Lambert about his company's sports bra/polyethylene bladder called the Wine Rack?
Essentially, it endows women with a little bigger chest and the opportunity to carry their favorite beverage wherever they go.
And how much can be fit into the Wine Rack?
Well, we're still in the final development stages, but we're somewhere in the neighborhood of about three cups.
Three cups?
Three cups. Kind of had to put a limit on how big these women wanted to get.
If you endowed a lucky sports fan in your life with any holiday gifts we suggested on Only a Game over the last 14 years, or you were lucky enough to have received one, we'd love to talk with you in time for this year's gift guide. Please leave a voice message on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Or you can write us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or email us at oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know how we can reach you via email or phone and which sports-related holiday gifts you have given or received. And thanks.
Six cups named Stanley.
I know that's a stretch, but the only other team sport that starts six players is beach volleyball, and I didn't think you needed to be reminded of that.
Five Boilermakers.
I know this basketball, that seemed too obvious.
Four Final Fours, three Triple Crowns, two repeats. And an eagle on a par three.
Yeah, now we're talking.
North Carolina sports teams are facing a fall drought. Not the sports hyperbole losing streak definition, but an actual drought. New conservation measures are forcing schools to cut back on water use on their athletic fields and find ways to make their limited resources last. Rachel McCarthy has our report.
The lush, smooth field at the Sass Soccer Park in Cary, North Carolina, looks like soccer heaven.
The ryegrass is growing well. We're mowing it daily. It's just a nice constant green color across the whole thing. But I don't think it looks that great. I always see the bad spots.
If Jimmy Simpson sounds like a perfectionist, it's because he has to be. His job is to make sure the field stays in tip-top shape for the high-profile matches played here, like next month's men's NCAA championship. Turf specialist and North Carolina State University professor Grady Miller is at the field too, preparing for a tour with some of his students. Miller's researched soccer field performance, and he says there's a lot to consider when assessing field quality.
How the ball would perform on the field, roll directions, hardness, cleat traction, and things like that.
And the top priority, he says, is player safety. Hard fields can cause tissue damage, and field divots lead to sprains or breaks. So this field needs a lot of attention and a lot of water, which could pose a problem since North Carolina is facing its worst drought on record. Cary, like many area towns, has suspended outdoor watering. But Jimmy Simpson says the soccer park doesn't face those restrictions.
Because we are on a well system, we're not pulling town water for use.
The stadium field gets 50,000 gallons of well water each week. And while it's perfectly legal, the well water argument doesn't wash with everyone.
The groundwater and the surface water are largely connected. It's the same water. And whether you pump it out of a lake or pump it out of a well, it's the same water.
According to Bill Holman of Duke University's Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions, a lot of people need to use that water.
There's a residential sector. There's an institutional sector, like a university, or even a school, a community college, a high school. There is an industrial sector, and then there's an agricultural sector. Everybody wants to be treated fairly, but also people want to continue to participate in athletics. There's a real balancing going on among these uses right now. We're going to have to use water more efficiently and be more creative going forward.
That means both conserving and exploring new ideas, even when they come from a rival.
Being based here at Duke, as much as I hate to say this, our colleagues at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill have already begun to collect rainwater that basically would be running off the roof, running off a parking lot, and capturing that, storing it underground, and then using it to irrigate their ball fields as necessary. So they're taking pressure off limited drinking water supplies.
As the UNC's women's soccer team warms up for a home game, Director of Athletic Facilities Kevin Robinson explains that many of UNC's practice fields are actually still on city water, so those surfaces have suffered. But the game field is fed by their sophisticated water reclamation system.
They're getting ready to play on it here in about 10 minutes, and the playing surface is excellent. Especially for soccer, the ball rolls across the surface of the field. Rather, you know, in spring we play lacrosse out there, and it's not as important for them because they're throwing the ball in the air. But again, back to soccer with it rolling on the ground, it's very important that we have a consistent, smooth playing surface for them to play on.
And smooth it is. There won't be any bad bounces for the defending women's NCAA champions as they look to improve upon their overall record of 263 wins and only 9 losses and 5 ties on their home field. After UNC's 4-1 victory over North Carolina State, the team celebrates next to the field, and senior forward Jamie Gilbert tells me how things look from her side of the ball.
It's the nicest field I've ever played on. On a field like this, you know, all that matters is soccer. Like, it's tough, like, when the field conditions are a factor, you know. You don't want that to, like, conflict with the outcome of the game or anything like that. So when I play on this field, it's just all about soccer. Honestly, like, I literally just found out we were in a drought. I didn't know.
What would you say to people who might say that athletic fields shouldn't be getting water as opposed to, like, agriculture?
It's not true. We obviously, a lot of people come out to watch our games, you know, so I definitely think that, like, if our field's not playable, you know, people are going to get hurt, you know, and no one in the stands wants to come out and see something like that. So definitely the field's obviously for the players, but it's also for the fans.
Water conservation expert Bill Holman agrees that fields do indeed serve the community.
Athletics is so important to our culture, for whether it's the soccer league that the kids are playing in, to high school football games on Friday night or college games on Saturday afternoon. There are a lot of people who participate and enjoy those activities, and so it's a priority.
With the drought expected to continue through the winter, Holman says North Carolinians can at least look forward to one thing, a full season of basketball on indoor courts. For Only a Game, I'm Rachel McCarthy in Durham, North Carolina.
You're listening to Only a Game. In response to the story on last week's show about the ongoing adventures of the football team at Appalachian State, Derek Brian Moore, who listens to Only a Game by downloading our podcast, wrote as follows. While I am thrilled Appalachian State beat the University of Michigan despite having only 63 scholarships and only a stadium that seats fewer than 17,000 people, I was astonished to learn from the Appalachian State website that it's a real university, and a damn fine one at that. In fact, I have friends who have graduated from that fine football college without ever playing football. We can only hope that this sudden attention can help the school overcome its dreaded status as a great liberal arts school and instead become known as a great football school. John Kiger, who hears the show on KCUR in Kansas City, and Chris Lovett, who hears the show on WBUR, were among the listeners who wrote with questions about the music we've been using on Only a Game. We slipped up last week and failed to list the music on our website, onlyagame.org, but it's up there now. We'll put last week's music on the web this week, too. Our story about rock climbing in the Red River Gorge reminded WBUR listener Stan Hitron of the fun that he had had climbing in that area 30 years ago. Thanks for stimulating some great memories, he wrote, and he wondered if our reporter, Kathleen Adams, had stumbled upon the town near the gorge, which Mr. Hitron reports is one of the more appropriately named bergs that he's encountered. It's called Nada. Stephen Gilmore of Charlotte, North Carolina, was no doubt representing a lot of sleepy baseball fans when he wrote to say he thinks the Fox Network has probably reduced the number of people who watch the World Series by starting the game so late and, quote, juicing up the telecasts with excess commercials. And finally, Aaron Todd at the Brown University Sports Foundation wrote to say, I've always enjoyed your show and the refreshing outlook you have on the sporting world. Congratulations on being honored as one of the top 15 most influential sports education teams in the U.S. by the Institute for International Sport. Quite an honor, well deserved. If we've educated, entertained, or outraged you, let us know by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our mailing address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jackie Bibby has done it again. Bibby, known among circles of madmen and their admirers as the Texas Snake Man, recently reclined in a clear plastic bathtub with 87 rattlesnakes. They can go wherever they want as long as they don't bite, Bibby said, and the snakes did go wherever they wanted, and they didn't bite, which meant that Mr. Bibby was alive to receive the news that he'd set a new world record for sharing a bathtub with snakes. Jackie Bibby also holds the world record for holding rattlesnakes in his mouth, 11, and he claims to have set the record for climbing into a sleeping bag full of rattlesnakes headfirst, 20. But that record is unsanctioned, which is just an outrage. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, world's greatest sporting event or world's greatest party, you decide. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Major League Baseball's free agent frenzy began during Game 4 of the World Series when Scott Boras, Supreme Agent of the Universe, announced that his star client was severing ties with the Yankees. It got a little stranger this week when the union issued a statement indicating that it is concerned teams might be colluding. What makes it think that?
Well, no, I mean, there's no reason for the union to think that except for the fact that they colluded for 3 years in the 1980s and denied doing it the whole time, and it cost them $380 million. There seems to be some talk that maybe teams are getting together to hold down Alex Rodriguez's price. Baseball, of course, denies this thoroughly. Baseball is, of course, barbering the truth just to an extent. But I really think that in this case, it's possible that the marketplace may actually work. There aren't many places for Alex Rodriguez to go.
Joe Torre is apparently too busy to worry about colluding or collude himself. He's working on his Yankee memoirs. Will he tell all?
Oh, I hope so, because, boy, is that going to be fun. although, I mean, if I were the Dodgers, I'd be a little bit concerned that he's, you know, he's taking the big check after you've signed him to a $13 million deal to manage your team. I don't know, you want him wallowing in the past, you know, even for a price. But if it is an honest book, and I suspect Torre may be too much of a gentleman to produce one, then it'll be interesting to read.
At their meetings in Florida this week, Major League Baseball's general managers voted to use replay, but just a little bit. Should their decision dismay fans who enjoy blaming umpires when their teams fail?
No, I mean, this is home runs. And given the way we put ballparks together now with all sorts of bells and whistles and the yellow line to determine whether or not it's a home run or not, I think this is probably a good idea.
Baseball's general managers also decided that base coaches should wear helmets from now on. Good idea?
Yeah, this is, of course, in reaction to Mike Coolbaugh, who was killed when he was hit in the head with a line drive. He's a coach for the Rockies minor league team in Tulsa. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not going to detract or add anything to the game one way or the other. It'll make these guys safer.
This has been the season of weird tennis stories. The International Tennis Federation is investigating whether German tennis player Tommy Haas was poisoned during a September Davis Cup match. Why would anybody poison a tennis player?
Because it's cheaper and more convenient than paying them to dump matches, I guess. I don't know.
There seems to be some of that going on.
apparently Tommy Haas has accused someone of slipping him a Machiavellian macchiato, resulting in some real, as they used to say in the old antacid commercials, distress in the lower tract. And the ITF crack investigating crew is on the case now.
Adrian Peterson, the rookie running back with the Minnesota Vikings, earned an extra $2.5 million earlier this season when he got past 700 yards rushing. Last weekend, he ran for 296 yards against San Diego. This put him on track to earn some more bonus money. Does he get the ball less often from now through December so they don't have to keep paying him more bonuses?
Look, far be it for me to dismiss anything like that out of hand, given what I know about the way the management side of sports, professional sports works. But he's all the Minnesota Vikings have. If they don't hand him the ball, they lose 73-0. So I suspect he's going to have a lot of opportunities to pick up the incentives.
I'm wondering if the Vikings having to lay out that extra cash might have inspired, if that's the correct word, the same team to dock wide receiver Troy Williamson a game's pay.
This is an impossible story. I'm not exactly sure what the Vikings are trying to prove here. He's being fined a total of $25,588 because he went to the Monday funeral of his grandmother. He has a brother who is in a coma. The grandmother raised them. We all know the story. We've told several dozen times. But I think the key part of the story is Coach Brad Childress, who told a press conference that the decision to dock Williamson's pay for this was based on a, quote, business principle of the Vikings organization. I don't know what I find more loathsome, the fact that he actually said it or the fact that NFL coaches are now talking like management gurus.
Shortly after the Patriots beat the Colts last weekend in the de facto Super Bowl XLII, Pats president Jonathan Kraft complained that Indianapolis had artificially enhanced the noise in the stadium there. Now it turns out that he was wrong, unless he was right. Help.
Well, Bill, let me tell you, what's up? No, there was some sort of feedback technological thing that got the Patriots are now desperate to divert everyone's attention to the fact that they've already been fined $500,000 for breaking the league rules. So this is now going to be the New England Patriots are developing within themselves an incredible ability to turn even their most devout fans into paranoid cranks. They're having the greatest year in the world, and for a lot of people, the only way they can enjoy it is to concoct scenarios by which the rest of the world is against them.
This week, Don Shula attempted to elucidate his feelings about the New England Patriots and their quest to become only the second NFL team to post a perfect season. Shula's 1972 Miami Dolphins are the only team to have done that. Is everything clear now regarding whether Don Shula thinks there should be an asterisk or something like that?
Of course, then again, even paranoids have real enemies. Don Shula ran his mouth and has walked it back. Look, the whole grumpy old guy thing about the 1972 Miami Dolphins got old. It passed its sell-by date about 10 years ago. Yes, you had a really good year. Yes, you were undefeated. Yes, this thing with the champagne was queued up till about a decade ago, as I said. you know what? Let him win. Let him lose. Who cares what Don Shula thinks? He's got a decent amount of credibility in the game. He should put it to better use.
Regarding basketball in Seattle, NBA Commissioner David Stern said this week that if the Supersonics leave town, Seattle will never again have an NBA team. How does he know what megalomaniacal multi-billionaire might wave enough dollars to get another team there someday?
Well, the elected officials in the state of Washington have said things that run counter to Mr. Stern's very lofty perception of himself. And he's pitching a bit of a fit here because somebody dare bring up the salaries that players are paid in connection with why they should or shouldn't build a new arena for the Sonics. I wouldn't trust the current ownership of the Seattle Sonics as far as I could throw whatever new building they built for them in Oklahoma City.
Eric Lindros announced his retirement this week, Charlie, and says that he might join the players' union. I guess that's a real good thing, considering the players could use a real fighter on their side.
Well, it's not just that, but he's been quite vocal and quite active since basically his career was cut short by a repeated series of concussions. He's been very active on that issue, very active on player safety. If that becomes his brief in the NHLPA, good on him, because they've needed someone like that for a long time.
Before we get to the NASCAR questions, Revolution's going to the championship.
Hey! Who are they playing?
Well, it depends. Either
they're not playing the Galaxy.
Either Kansas City or Houston, whoever wins tonight.
They played Houston last year, right?
Right.
And it didn't work out real well.
It'll be fine this
time.
Let's
play Kansas City.
Mr. NASCAR,
hey!
I present to you the 2007 Cup Chase standings as we head into the penultimate week of competition. Please gaze into your crystal ball joint and tell us who will prevail.
Oh, Jeff Gordon's going to win the thing. You know that. He's laying in the weeds behind Jimmy Johnson right now. He's going to do it. Half of NASCAR is going to love it. Half of NASCAR is going to hate it.
Pro wrestling lost another of its stars this week. This time, as far as I know, steroids played no role in her death. Do you suppose the WWE will dedicate the remainder of its season to the fabulous Moolah?
We giggle, but at one point in this country's history, there was no more famous athlete in the United States of America than the fabulous Moolah. She's one of those iconic names like Babe or Ty or Secretariat
fabulous.
Or Fabulous. We don't have any athletes confident enough in their abilities to just call themselves fabulous anymore.
And finally, Charlie,
woo!
I don't know what the University of Oregon's record will be at the end of the football
season. I don't care. Look
but
at these photos.
If it is a disappointing season for you, Oregon, at least nobody will be able to say their quarterback was distracted by academic responsibilities.
I'm sorry. We got this story off a website where various young ladies who pretty clearly didn't go to Baylor
moving right
are
along.
Hanging out. Back to the story now. Yeah, apparently he's taking one class, Bill, and the class is billiards. Rock him!
I hope he does.
Rock him up!
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Baccalaureate in the corner pocket.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. In Love and Blood, his new book about the World Cup, Jamie Trecker writes, simply put, there is nothing else like it. The Olympics would love to be it. The Super Bowl and World Series are merely pretenders to it. And as lots of U.S. sports fans howl their dismay at that assertion, Jamie Trecker joins me from NPR Chicago Bureau. Jamie, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start with the numbers with which you make the case for the World Cup as supreme. Compare for me the number of people who watch the Super Bowl, according to the NFL, with the number of people who will watch the draw for the first round of the World Cup.
Yeah, it's quite surprising. I mean, literally billions of people will tune in to watch soccer, but, you know, only about 350 million people, tune in to watch our Super Bowl. It's quite interesting because in this country we always think of the Super Bowl, the World Series, to be all supreme in terms of all sports. And the World Cup just dwarfs that to a magnitude that I don't think people really can even imagine until they've actually seen it.
You write, and perhaps lament is the more accurate term, that, quote, something essential about the World Cup has changed, and that now it's not so much, quote, the world's greatest sporting event as the world's greatest party. How has that happened?
Well, I think what happened was back in 2002, because the World Cup at that point was being split between two countries for the first time, and of course the two countries are Korea and Japan, and they're separated by a sea, so there was no way that a fan in either country could possibly see every game in person. So what they did was they made these large public viewing areas for people that turned out to be an enormous success. In Seoul, you know, basically 15 million people turned out to watch one of their critical games, and the people that run World Soccer saw this as a tremendous way to capture new people that, you know, had not been able to purchase tickets for World Cups in the past. And so when the World Cup rolled around in Germany, Germany set up all these so-called fan festivals, which were just basically large open-air areas that were capable of holding, you know, hundreds to thousands to millions of people that could watch the game on giant TV sets. And it really changed the dynamic. Before the World Cup, you know, it was, I hate to say this, but it was kind of elitist. It was, you know, getting into a World Cup match was special because it was so rare. And if you went over, you know, you were lucky to see maybe one game in person. With changing it so that it became more open, what it did in a way was it changed more into a kind of like a collegiate football tailgate. Something, you know, it's great that more people were able to see the cup. But what they did is basically they were really not watching the cup. They were watching a giant television surrounded and paid for by sponsors and with a lot of commercial messages thrown in.
From your description of the fan fests, it sounds as if a fair number of the people who showed up were actually not capable of seeing what was on those screens. They were, you know, drinking for 8 or 10 hours before the game actually started.
Yeah, you know, there was a very, very heavy alcohol consumption, especially among the, you know, the English fans and the Serbian fans and the German fans and most of the fans.
The Dutch fans and
the Dutch fans. Yeah, it was pretty unbelievable. I was at one bar where the Australian fans actually drank it dry, and they were so proud that they had, you know, basically drunk a bar in Munich dry that they took the poor bartender onto their shoulders and paraded him into the street. I think he thought he was going to be murdered by them, but in reality, they were just very proud.
If somebody, it's a great scene in the book because somebody working in the establishment actually stands up and announces, "We have no more beer."
Yeah, that was about the only English he knew too, and he was not, he wasn't really prepared for the repercussions.
I watched a lot of the games in the 2006 World Cup, and I thought I had seen some excellent soccer, but you say that that World Cup will be remembered mostly for its ugliness. Why?
You know, I thought the World Cup at this particular juncture really represented a kind of a saturation point in the number of games that players are forced to play for their clubs. You know, the World Cup is a competition between national teams, and all these players during the rest of the year are playing on their club teams in various leagues around the planet. What happened was I think that you saw a great many teams come in with their star players just exhausted. And I talked about Thierry Henry, the great French striker, and talked about Ronaldinho from Brazil as well. They had played in very rough tournaments just prior to that. Obviously, Arsenal had met Barcelona in the Champions League. The two players had faced off against each other. They'd been playing, you know, 60, 70 matches in the run-up to it before they even, you know, got to step out in the German heat of the 2006 summer. It really showed just how much is being taken away from the game when players are forced to play all the time year-round and never get a break. You know, every sport has a break, but soccer is one of the weird things that because of the year-round calendar, players just never get any time off anymore. It's great for a writer like me because there's always something to talk about, but it really led to a lot of very, very poor first-round matches and some very poor knockout-round matches as well, unfortunately.
Well, assuming you're right, and the reason that the World Cup isn't a better soccer exhibition than it is that so many of the players are exhausted, what are the chances that FIFA, the international games governing body, will do something to restore the luster that you feel the World Cup has lost?
I don't think they can, honestly. They've been trying to. They've been trying to limit the number of games that the players play. But the fact of the matter is that the club game is now in ascendance. I mean, the Champions League tournament, which is going on right now in Europe, features, you know, virtually every great club in the world playing for a yearly European crown. Those clubs are huge money makers. They're wildly and rapidly followed. I saw a statistic the other day that said that the Arsenal-Manchester United game that was played last Saturday in the English Premier League drew 1 billion overseas viewers. People are watching these games. And when you have that kind of pressure and that kind of financial responsibility, it's very difficult to tell a club that is paying for a player, insuring a player, you know what, you shouldn't play him every game. No club's going to do that. And, you know, I think if an American thought about that, if, you know, if A-Rod or you know, Derek Jeter or somebody was said, you know, you can't play that game because you've got to go play for the, you know, the United States national team, people would laugh. They'd say, no, of course your club comes first. And that's what's happening in soccer right now.
Jamie Trecker is the author of Love and Blood at the World Cup with the Footballers, Fans, and Freaks. It's published by Harcourt. He joined me from the NPR Bureau in Chicago. Jamie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Julian Soperidi. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from University of Pennsylvania student Matt Harrison, football fan and crooner.
Drink a highball at nightfall, and we'll toast to dear old Penn.
Well, I suppose it's a good thing they don't throw highballs. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.